Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1987, features Charles Sparr, retired Chief Executive Officer of SoHio, who tells of his progress through the ranks to become leader of a major corporation and gives the inside story of how he directed the building of the Alaska Pipeline. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
My name is Charles Sparr. All of my friends call me Charlie. I like that. I've spent all of my business life in the petroleum industry, beginning as an engineer in the oil fields and winding up as a chief executive of my company, and I had the pleasure of directing the affairs of that company for about 19 years. And I have the satisfaction now, as I think back about the experiences that we had, that was on the whole quite a satisfactory one. And we did a good job together in that company for the country, for the communities in which we worked, for the people who supplied us, for those whom we served as suppliers, and for our stockholders and those wonderful people who worked for the company's employees making all of this possible. And particularly I'm glad to think that while we started out under my regime as a small regional refiner marketer, we wound up being the largest producer of domestic crude oil in the United States. But I left the industry at the end of 1977 when I retired. I was almost 65. We had completed a gigantic project in Alaska, helping to develop the North Slope oil field and build a pipeline that would bring that oil to Tidewater. And I thought it was time to turn to some other things that needed attention, in my view, and they would be areas in which I thought I could be useful. These things boil down to two: education and the moral arena. I'm interested in improving the quality of secondary school education, particularly that of the independent schools, and improving the quality and helping finance, in both instances, higher education, the college and the university level. As far as morality is concerned, I feel that civilization as we know it can only exist if we have the growing, strengthening moral influence of the churches and of those organizations that, by their own organization and design, can help the churches with the moral problem. This is why I spend time on seminaries, helping them develop and revise curricula, helping them consolidate, become more ecumenical than they might have been in order to attract more support and faith from those who can provide the means to help them exist. And this is why I work in Freemasonry, because the organization, as I understand it, and I've been in it quite some time, is designed mainly to bring men who are monotheists together, regardless of their specific kind of religion, to work in the interest of one another and in mankind through their faith and their hope and their charitable acts. So I'm still doing that in Ohio and look forward to having the opportunity of working in these fields for a few more years yet as my hair turns whiter and the wrinkles become more obvious.
Charlie, if you don't mind, since you suggested that you like to be called that, you're a Midwesterner, is that correct?
Yes, I was born in Kansas and grew up in western Missouri.
Where did you go to college? In the Midwest?
Yes, I went to the University of Kansas, a state tax-supported school where I obtained my baccalaureate degree in civil engineering and mechanical engineering.
In addition to engineering, were there any subjects that you were particularly interested in?
Well, I will admit that I early developed an idea that I wanted to be a builder and leave the world with some edifices or engineering construction that would improve the quality of life in the areas where they might exist and make it possible for more people to live more comfortably. I was influenced by reading about the Panama Canal, which was a fairly new thing when I was a high school boy, about the Suez Canal, about the pyramids, about the construction methods used as much as we knew about them. I got intrigued by the problems of water supply, hydrology in this country, and was entranced by the idea that I might someday be able to build a magnificent dam on some river that would impound the water and make irrigation possible, things of that kind. So I wanted to be a builder. That's why I became an engineer. That's why I became a civil engineer and studied the construction majors that were available to me.
Was there any person who led you to that goal?
I didn't understand your question.
Was there any person, any individual, whom you were trying to follow in their footsteps?
Bob, there may have been, but I don't remember that there was any individual whose steps I was trying to follow. But I clearly recall some influences. My paternal grandfather was a minister in the Methodist Church. And in that ministry, he went where the church hierarchy said he should go. Among other things, when my father was a youngster in his teens, Granddad was sent to Coffeyville, Kansas, on the southern Kansas border, at a time before Oklahoma had become a state. And it was a rough area. And Granddad preached against whiskey and murder and mayhem, as was necessary in the kind of climate that existed in those days. And he was a brave man. He didn't claim that he was, but it was obvious from the stories that Dad told me and that Grandfather told me that I can remember that he was a brave man and that he was a constructive person. And I'm sure that my knowledge of what he did had some substantial influence on the way I viewed things. And my father was a farmer as well as a refinery worker. He was a moonlighter, you might say, and probably worked an average of 13, 14 hours a day at both things. And he was successful at both things in what we'd call a modest way today. We never had much money in the family, but we always had plenty to eat and plenty to wear, and we were healthy, and we cooperated with one another to make our farm profitable and possible. And I'm sure that the illustrations that I had from my father and my mother, too, who was a woman of many capacities, influenced my attitude toward life and toward work and toward constructive thinking.
Well, those are pretty strong role models. Did you have a boyhood hero?
Boyhood hero? Probably Colonel Guthels of the Panama Canal fame was one of the principal ones. Abraham Lincoln was another. George Washington, a bit more remote. I learned about more and more as life went by. He became something equivalent to a hero to me.
What was your first job?
Shoveling apples into a cider mill when I was 12 years old.
How much did that pay, incidentally?
25 cents an hour. A penny would buy more in those days than it will buy now. So.
What was your first job out of college, once you had graduated from college?
After I graduated from college, I obtained a job in the Sugar Creek, Missouri refinery of the Standard Oil Company of Indiana, working in the power station as a power station clerk and later as a boiler operator.
At that time, when you were in that first job, did you at any point think of yourself in the future as leaving engineering and going into management?
Not while I was in the first job.
When did that first occur? When did you first have this interest in management?
After I'd been working as an engineer in the oil business about 3 years. At that time, I had left Standard of Indiana and had joined the Phillips Petroleum Company, whose headquarters are in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. And Phillips had sent me out to the Texas Panhandle, to an area called Borger, Texas, where great gas fields existed and oil fields were being developed. And the complexity and the magnitude of that activity intrigued me, and I decided that I wasn't educated enough to be able to manage operations of that complexity and magnitude, and I better get some more education. And shortly thereafter, when I began thinking this way, I had some conversations with a couple of friends who had done graduate work in one business school or another. These experiences made me decide that I better get some business training too.
And where did you get that business training?
Well, and I left Phillips to go back to the Harvard Graduate School of Business Administration in the fall of 1937. So I became a member of their class of 39.
And when you left the Harvard Business School, and I assume with an MBA degree, where did you go?
I went back to Bartlesville for a short time, but it was only about 6 months or so after I returned there that I had an opportunity brought to my attention by my boss to be interviewed by representatives of the Standard Oil Company here in Cleveland. That led to my joining that company, with which I stayed, as I think you know, throughout the rest of my career in the oil business.
Well, you've certainly had a successful career. Did luck play a part in this? Was all this carefully planned, or did the hand of fate guide you?
Oh, the hand of fate had a lot to do with it. I've called it Lady Luck. I do think one has to be purposeful, and he has to be ready to take advantage of opportunities that may come his way, or he may have to seek them out if they don't seem to be too visible. But in the end, you have to be in the right place, I think at the right time, know it, and then do something about it. And I really think I've been favored over my life at being at the right place at the right time a good many times, and I'm grateful.
What skill or work habit contributed most to your success?
That's a hard question to answer. I'm a fairly tenacious fellow. I think I've always been a problem solver from the time that I can recall facing problems. I've never been willing to leave the problem unsolved for very long. I've sometimes had to sleep on things before I could be refreshed enough to have the vision enough to see the way toward a solution. But I believe perhaps tenacity, supported by good, strong physique, perhaps abetted by curiosity, and I have a lot of that, might be the main reasons why I've been able to do what I did do.
A lot of hours of work?
Oh, yes. 40 hours a week isn't very long, Bob. I'm sure that I never worked that little. 60 hours would be more like it, I suppose, but I never kept a diary on my time. Work wasn't slavery or drudgery for me ever. In a way, it was an avocation, not a sport exactly, but I got quite a lot of a thrill, you might say, out of working and accomplishing things and seeing them done, and seeing the results of the work being productive. Consequently, I never spent much time on my golf game or even on my tennis game earlier. And while I could get by and not be ridden out of sight by those who didn't think I did well enough, I was never a champion. I was lucky enough to win a few things from time to time when I was young, and to enjoy things, but I never became adept at those games that require a lot of effort in order to be skillful.
I assume then, as a retiree, that then you've still continue to work in a certain sense then?
Well, here we are sitting in my office, which I've maintained in this place and previously down in the Terminal Tower ever since I left the company. I did some consulting work in the beginning of my retirement experience, and I was continued to be on and joined some additional boards of directors and stayed pretty active in the business arena for about 7 years, but progressively left that kind of activity as my chronological age disqualified me from successive terms on those boards of directors. So I turned my attention to smaller enterprise, and all during this experience I started to work more and more in Masonic activity, and I guess I persisted from a time well before I retired in working in the educational field and raising money and considering curricula and things of that kind. And I've continued to do that, and I'm still doing that kind of thing. Now that I'm 74 years old, too old for major corporations to want to court me for my services, I find that my interests lie in small business, where I can still be useful, and in education and masonry, as I've told you before.
In your activities in small business, when you confront a young person who has an idea for a business, what kind of characteristics do you look for in that person? What kind of personality traits that would suggest to you that person has a chance of success? Is there something?
Well, I'm not alone in my efforts to identify these people. I have 9 associates and little capital investment business that I'm in, so I have some help in looking for qualities that I may not be perceptive enough to think about. But I do look for honesty, for energy, for a certain orderliness of thought, a certain conviction that given funds or management help that he will succeed. These are absolutely necessary. But then also today, Bob, more perhaps than yesterday, you have to see how well a man is organized, how much he knows about the need to get legal advice, what his attitude is about people, whether he likes them or not, whether he has biases or not. All these things are important. But as I rattle along here, I'm trying to think of what the real answer to you should be. I think that perhaps vision that can be supported by logical explanation of how the vision can actually be brought to reality is a principal quality I'm looking for.
In their book, In Search of Excellence, the book written by Peters and Waterman,
yes,
they make a clear distinction between managers and leaders. Do you have any views on that question?
Well, yes, I do. I think a leader must have a thorough knowledge of what management requires, or he won't be successful in what he wants to do. But a manager working in a company with specific products in specific places, with workforces and with you might say directives and aids that have been developed by others, only needs to be a diligent, reasonable man who likes people, knows how to utilize them, but he doesn't have to have the vision, the imagination, the desire to make changes that the real leader must have.
It's said that individuals change their behavior and their outlook when they move to high levels of responsibility. For example, when you become president of the United States or a member of the Supreme Court. Does becoming a chief executive officer have the same effect?
Well, Your question is fairly general. I do think that people change as they go through life, and that they must change constantly, expand, if you will, if they're going to be successful and enjoy life. If they can't add to their qualities and their abilities and so on, I think that they will reach the plateau of their capabilities pretty quickly. But I don't think a person to be successful has to change or should change in his attitude toward people or toward questions of moral activity or evaluation, things of that kind. Maybe I lived at the right time for a person of my beliefs. But I really think you can succeed if you stick to the principles that you learn as a young person and apply them as you obtain greater power and ability to expand your influence. I probably didn't answer you very well, but I tried.
Well, tell us about your appointment as CEO of Sahio. Tell us about that. When did it occur? How did it occur? How did you find out about it? How did you feel?
Well, of course, I felt great when I learned that I was going to have the chance to run the company. I had become a vice president of Standard Oil Company, in charge of their transportation activity, several years before I became president. When I first became the vice president for transportation, which included pipeline transportation and barges, waterways, and so on, I was soon given an opportunity to volunteer to go to Washington. This was in the early part of 1952, to become the director of supply and transportation for the Petroleum Administration for Defense. And this was in the last year of the Korean War. And I was 37 at the time, and this experience afforded me a great opportunity to expand my acquaintanceship in the oil industry and in the supplier groups and in government in Washington and elsewhere, far beyond what I might have managed in 5 years if it hadn't have happened. So when I came back to the company, I guess the management, recognizing the advantages they had given me, perhaps inadvertently, added to my responsibilities, and I soon found that in 1955, 3 years later, I was the executive vice president in charge of all the operations except oil production and exploration. And then in 1957, I was made president, chief operating officer, in charge of all operations. Now, at that time, I think this is an interesting story, and may be revealing in some ways. The president of the company, listening to the board of directors, which included about 50% outsiders, decided that in the interest of the stockholders, he should look at the best candidate inside, and the board should seek for and find the best possible one from the outside, and then compare the two and select the best. So a committee of outside directors was appointed to search for a potential president of the company outside. And they found a man, they identified him. And then I was interviewed by the chairman of that committee and was told that the committee really felt that the outsider, being older, more experienced in the chemical field, he was in a chemical company, than I, would probably be a better chief executive than I would be, at least in the beginning. But that it would be essential for him to have my support and assistance because he'd never been in the oil business before and he didn't really know the company. And I was asked if I would cooperate. And I said, no, I'll quit. And I was asked why I would do that. And I said, well, I simply have enough confidence in myself now, and I have enough knowledge in the business. I've had some war experience. I've met a lot of people. I know I can get a job just as good as the one I have now, given a little time, if you don't need me as president. And I'm not going to question your judgment, but I'm not going to support somebody else that you think is better than I, when at the same time you say he needs me, when I tell you I don't think I need him. So I got the job. And I expect that that conversation I just told you about had some substantial influence upon their decision as to what kind of a man I was. I thought about it a lot since.
In other words, having confidence in yourself and in your own judgment has to be a very important starting point.
I think so, yes.
Did you ever, at any point, have a feeling of ownership of Sohio? As chief executive, do you kind of feel, well, this is mine?
Oh, Robert, I actually don't think so, no. I, of course, invested in the company, so that I had the feeling it was partly mine. But it was only a minor investment compared to the total of all the stockholders. So I believe I can truthfully say that I always harbored the understanding that the company was not mine. It belonged to other people as well as to me, and that I owed my allegiance to all of them, and I owed them the best effort I could put out to improve their investment and the total activity of the company.
Would better words be caretaker or trustee? Are those better words to describe the CEO's job in a public company?
As a trustee?
Yes, either as a caretaker or a trustee. Is that
a I object to the word caretaker. I think that one who becomes a caretaker, a conservator, and sees his job in that light is not going to do much other than to preserve it, and probably won't do that in an industrial climate that is constantly changing. A trustee, I think the responsibility is partly that. You have someone else's investment property in your hands, and you're to do with that the best you can for him or her. And so, yes, I think you are a trustee, but not a caretaker. As a trustee, you must be an innovator, an aggressive merchandiser of ideas, a successful searcher for opportunities, things of that kind.
Is today's business climate upsetting to you in that regard? Do you see signs that this attitude isn't widely held?
Well, I am concerned about things that happen these days. Yes, I really deplore what I think is far too much concentration on the part of too many able people, men and women, to find ways through financial ingenuity and manipulation, if you will, to build personal fortunes through insider leverage buyouts and takeovers and things of that kind. I believe that the opportunities to do this and the intriguing nature of these kinds of challenges that lure these people, take away able people from the business of, you might say, constructing new capital assets that will be productive and create jobs and add more wealth to the country. I think this is too bad, and I am sure that the phase will go by one day and that we'll have more concentration again on, you might say, productive management rather than financial management and manipulation. I'm glad I was active at the time I was before this kind of complicating thing for me got started and developed to such a great extent.
Well, you mentioned your activities as a Mason. When did you first become interested in Freemasonry?
About 27 years ago.
Can you tell us about it? What brought it to your attention or led to your interest?
Well, a friend of mine, now gone, who was a Mason, simply asked me one time if I'd ever thought about becoming one. And I had said, well, not really. My father and my paternal grandfather before him had been Masons, but they had never talked to me about it or urged me to think about it. This was in accordance with the prevailing thought of the day, which prevails almost right down to the present time, that one does not ask a person to join the Masons. The initiative has to come from the one who develops the interest. Anyway, my friend asked me if I had ever thought about it, and I said no, and he asked if I would like to learn something about it. And with the history of my father and grandfather, I thought, well, it was high time that I did learn something about it. It led me to join. I wasn't able to be very active in a leadership role for a long, long time because my company and my family, in reverse order, my family and my company came first. And that was all right with the Masonic fraternity. They encouraged that.
Tell us what the purpose of Freemasonry is. For someone who's not been involved in it, how can they best understand it?
Well, Freemasonry requires, for eligibility, that a man be a monotheist. He must believe in one God. Masonry does not interfere with a man's religion. He can be a Christian, a Jew, a member of Islam. He can define his God in his own fashion. But as long as he's a monotheist, he's eligible. And the thesis, it seems to me, is this, that men can form a brotherhood, as Masonry is, if they believe in God, regardless of how they define Him. And by being in one brotherhood, they can make the world a better place and minimize the antagonisms that would otherwise arise because of religious differences or economic ambitions or things of that kind. Masons embrace the thesis that faith in God and hope in the future and charity to one's fellow man are ruling principles for living. And to the extent that they can improve their performance in these important areas of living by being reminded of their Masonic commitments, the better leaders they will become, the better people of influence in their own communities, it seems to me. Masonry's origins are lost in the haze of time. There are myths about origins, but the symbolic Freemasonry that we know today seems to have really developed and become strong in Europe about 350 years ago.
Is Masonry today as vital an aspect of society as it has been in the past, in your view?
Oh, I think it is. It is not as perhaps alone and outstanding in its influence as it was 100, 200 years ago, because there are so many other things that have developed in these intervals of time. But we have many lodges in our communities. There are well over 600 in the state of Ohio alone, and in their local areas where they do exist, dependent upon leadership, which does vary in quality, they are able to do quite a lot of things of benefit in their communities. They endorse philanthropic enterprises of one kind or another. They carry on campaigns. You've heard of the Shrine Hospitals for Children. You may have heard of the efforts of the Scottish Rite to provide funds for research in what causes schizophrenia, try to solve that major problem, and there are a host of other things that I could tell you about that they try to do. But there are other groups doing similar things for those in the country who need help. And so Masonry now becomes more just a part or a unit among a number who are trying to do good in the country. But I still think they have a major place Even though there are many more ways of interesting men and women and doing things that give them no time for masonry these days.
What is the most common misconception of masonry that you encounter with non-masons?
Well, I think that the most common misconception is that it is a secret and therefore perhaps reprehensible society. We respond to that criticism by saying we are not a secret society. We have many open meetings. We have certain rituals that are secrets. But we take no political activity, no political sides. We allow no Masonic organization to do that. We're now trying to interest families in Masonic activity and bring them into open meetings more than we used to, realizing that people must know more about us if they're to believe in us and to get rid of that concept that we're a secret society. We're finally finding, I think, that communication on our part toward the public is highly necessary these days when communication has been developed in so many adept ways for almost everything else.
Is there a benefit, or if you would, a crossover between your Masonic membership and your business activities? How did those two work together?
Well, they're not in opposition to one another. I don't think that one can expect them to be mutually supportive in a very noticeable way. Masonic activity is more like church or community activity. It can be done and it should be done at times when one isn't involved in working for his own food and home and so on. There is a connection, and I may have touched upon this before, it's that active practice of masonry has a constructive, positive influence on the individual who's practicing it and keeps him perhaps more morally attuned to his obligations as a human being in a God-loving society than might be the case otherwise.
How long after becoming CEO of Sohio did you start working on the Prudhoe Bay oil field?
I became the CEO in 1959 after having become president in 1957. It was in 1968, in the late summer, that the Discovery wells in northern Alaska were drilled. And it was in the latter part of 68 and then the first half of 69 that I worked on the development of the agreement with the British Petroleum Company that led to our becoming involved in the Alaskan activity in June of 1969. So it really was 10 years after I became CEO that I got involved in the Alaskan venture.
How did you have such a position? How did Sohio gain the position they had in that particular venture?
Well, here are the factors. BP was known to have extensive acreage in Prudhoe Bay, and it had made one of the two discovery wells. Atlantic Richfield had drilled the first one, but BP's came in shortly thereafter. But BP had no other operating activity in the oil industry in the United States of any note. It was not in the United States market at all. It had no refineries in this area. It was in almost every other important place in the world, but not here in this country, which was the most important market in the world, and it wanted to be. And it had concluded, I think, that the best way to come in would be by some means whereby it could utilize the efforts and the knowledge and experience of people already working in and knowing about the matters that affected the industry here and how to cope with them. So that was their side of it. My company was still a marketer refiner. We had expanded by this time outside the limits of Ohio. We had diversified into chemicals. We had developed a pretty fine research activity with some very important discoveries. We had diversified into coal and were successful at that. And we had developed a fairly extensive series of motels and restaurants on the new interstate highway system. And we were improving our return on investment quite steadily, year by year, and at the same time maintaining the best reputation as the most efficient marketer in the areas where we were. And BP knew this. And I knew, though, that we were going to have to be more successful in finding crude oil. We were weak in that area. We were making efforts. We were buying reserves in the ground that had been proved by others. But we did not produce more than one barrel out of every four that we refined. So I was looking for opportunities to become a producer and supply our refineries. These two desires on the part of the two companies led to our contacting one another and developing the agreement whereby we acquired all of BP's properties in North America and they acquired that substantial stock interest in us.
Well, to a person who went to college with the idea of being a builder, the pipeline was certainly a big challenge.
Yes.
Was it a challenge more, or did it ultimately become more, a challenge of engineering or a political challenge?
Well, in the beginning, it was a tremendous engineering challenge and remained so throughout the experience of building it. But all of us involved had the confidence that we knew how to solve those problems and that we would how and we would solve them. Our logistics problems were tremendous. We had great distances to cover in bringing materials to the North Slope, and we had terrific weather handicaps that we had to cope with. But we felt we could figure all those out, and we actually did. So the political problem, which in the beginning didn't appear to be very great, became the toughest one, the most difficult to solve, and the worst one in terms of consuming a lot of time. And our experiences made it pretty clear that political problems that are involved in developments of great magnitude are very likely always going to be perhaps the knottiest problems, requiring the most imaginative solutions and the greatest adeptness as tacticians if things are to be worked out.
Well, in this case, it was a lot of the problem had to do with environmental claims or concerns of environmental problems.
Yes.
Did the environmental arguments, did they have any merit?
Oh, I'm sure that there was some merit to some environmental arguments. I want to avoid the error of classifying all environmentalists as one kind of group. There were those who were helpful to us as well as those who opposed us. But those who contended that we would be destructive to the caribou because we would interfere with their migration routes to their grazing grounds in the north were only guessing. They were terrible opposition. They were vocal. They came from major urban centers, not from the hinterland with which we were concerned. And they knew how to take advantage of their political connections to make things difficult for us. I'm sure that almost all of them were sincere, but I'm just as sure that if they had thought a bit, they would have realized that they were claiming sometimes things for which they had no proof. For example,
That caribou herd that with which they were concerned is now four times as large, I understand, as it was in 1969.
And this is roughly 20 years later. So that in 20 years it's quadrupled in size.
Yes, yes. Now, I think we've proven, Bob, that on the record, that we could and did develop that great oil field and build a pipeline without any destructive influence of any measurable amount upon the environment to which we went. Some of the pipeline right away, or where the pipeline's buried, looks like one long golf course. And the elevated portions of the line are well maintained and will be until there's no longer any need for the line, and then it'll be removed. We met many problems. We had to design solutions for, but they were designed successfully. We really didn't interfere with the salmon as they made their migrations up the streams to spawn. But even with this record in, it appears now in connection with the National Wildlife Preserve in northeastern Alaska that all of our experience has either been ignored or forgotten, and it seems that the same arguments are being made by the opponents of exploring in the preserve that were made 15 years ago when we were trying to get started. It's hard to learn, I guess, from one generation to another.
What is your response to those who would argue that had the environmentalists not brought pressure to bear, this enlightened approach would never have been taken?
Your question is, what is my response to that?
Yes. How do you convince people that Sohio would have acted responsibly if the even if the environmentalists had not raised the fuss?
Well, the only way that we could have convinced them would have been by the experience that we would have been allowed to have at that time. But in all honesty, I think that the opposition we encountered, particularly in the beginning, was healthy because it did make us be doubly sure that our designs were good. And we had to respond to the opinions or questions of some experts that worked for them on matters that we might not have thought about so seriously. So I think we did a better job than we would have done otherwise, and that the corrections that have to be made from time to time are far, far less than they probably would have been. We probably would have built the line differently, however, and far less expensively, without cutting corners, but by using different design for support and right of way.
What was the most significant engineering surprise that you had during the effort?
Surprise?
Yes.
I am not sure. So much exploratory, experimental, and you might say pilot work had been done in that four-year interval while we were solving the political problems that I really am not able to recall that we ran into any great surprises when we actually got underway with construction. We weren't startled by something that we hadn't thought about or hadn't considered. For example, one of our major problems was getting tons and tons and tons of materials under the North Slope location by water during a short 6-week season during which the ice was free out of the Bering Strait. And by having been up there several years, we were well aware of what we were going to be up against, and we could plan for it logistically. But Mother Nature never follows the same exact pattern every year. And so in 1 year, we found that Bering Strait didn't stay open as long as we had counted on. We had quite a few barges stuck in the ice after delivering their cargo to Prudhoe Bay, and they stayed in the ice all winter. But that wasn't a major problem for us. We were able to continue work. We did have materials on hand, and we were able to free those barges and had very little loss as a consequence.
Going to a broader area of interest, what is your overall view of the current state of government regulation of business, looking back on your career and what now is going on?
Well, I think that business enjoys a more favorable climate provided by the government now than it did 10 years ago. As you know, a lot of regulatory restrictions have been removed in a number of industries, including transportation, and it's easier to do things now in many ways by companies that already exist. I do think that the problems that exist today for people who want to go into business are more severe than they used to be, and severe enough to be discouraging to many who probably would contribute to our way of life through their production if they didn't have so much red tape to go through. But they get discouraged and they give up. So on the one hand, existing businesses can work with more freedom and less regulation while still having to report. And on the other hand, it's harder for new people to get started. Much more expensive, much more complicated, need much more legal advice. You have to be concerned about your employment practices to a very substantial degree. Well, I guess I've answered you as best I can.
Is the U.S. Capable of competing in world markets?
I didn't understand that.
Are we capable of competing in world markets in the next two or three decades?
Oh, I think so. I really do think so. Probably adjustments are taking place right now, long needed, that will enhance our ability to compete in world markets. You've noticed yourself that the dollar compared to the yen and the German mark is far less valuable now than it was in past years when it was the dollar was so costly that it made our exports difficult to sell and made imports much more attractive here than they might otherwise have been. I think that we are a very capable, diverse people in this country and probably have more capacities than we used to as a result of the immigrations that have taken place in recent years. And I'm optimistic about what we can do. I really am.
Are the chances of a young engineer from Kansas becoming CEO of a major company as good today as when you started?
I think so. Perhaps they're better. This is a great, marvelous country. We have lots of problems, as we both know, but there's still so much opportunity for almost anyone who has health and who is willing to work. Let's don't worry about the future from this point of view.
But of course, there have been a lot of changes since you left college.
Yes. Yes, but there have also been a lot of successes that have been put on the record by people much younger than I who have come along after some of these changes have taken place. That'll happen again.
Yeah. Well, is this change something that is the price we pay for progress? Do we always have to anticipate change?
Sure we do. The nature of the world is one of change. The nature of society is one of change. So when one looks back at history only for a few hundred years, the changes that are on the record are extensive, marvelous, and almost overpowering in their scope. Think what the world was like in 1492 when Columbus came over here.
Yes, it was a bit different.
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic about America's future?
I am indeed. We've just had the benefit of going through the bicentennial of the writing of our Constitution, and we've been reminded of by having this experience of the strengths that we have in this country that aren't enjoyed elsewhere. We've been reminded of the kind of opportunities we have because of the wonderful imagination and purpose that those framers of the Constitution possessed, which we're enjoying today. And we're demonstrating, I think, that we also, when it becomes necessary, are smart enough to amend the Constitution in a way that will permit the country to go on under circumstances that weren't envisioned by the founders. This is a great country. I'd rather be here than anywhere else.
What is the most important advice you have offered or that you plan to offer to your children and grandchildren about how they can work toward that future?
Well, I've had lots of conversations with my children, Bob. I guess the most important advice is to believe in yourself, believe in the moral ideals that you have learned from your father and mother and the forebears. Be diligent in your search for education and for opportunity. Have faith in yourself and in your fellow man, but always be careful in analyzing opportunities, risks, as well as gains, and be careful in the way you control things, not leave things to luck. And you'll have real fun in life, and that's about all I can say, I guess.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.